This episode is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 63 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com. So, you know, it's funny how we usually visualize the financial system.
How do you mean?
Well, like, when we think about a massive Wall Street investment firm, we always picture this giant faceless monolith, right?
Oh, totally. Like a towering skyscraper made of glass and steel.
Exactly. A glowing logo at the very top. And we just think of the firm as this, you know, single collective entity moving billions of dollars around, like chess pieces.
Yeah, well, that's a very intentional image. I mean, the industry spends billions on marketing to make you feel like you're investing with a fortress, you know, a fortress of stability, rather than just handing your life savings to a group of regular flawed people.
Exactly. But then you step into the world of state securities regulation, and suddenly that entire monolith just shatters.
It really does.
The state regulators, they look at that skyscraper and say, "We don't care about your fancy logo. We want to know exactly which human being on the 42nd floor is telling a retiree to buy that mutual fund."
Yep. They want the specific person.
They want that person's name, their 10-year employment history, their home address, and, like, their fingerprints.
It is the absolute definition of piercing the corporate veil. Because from a regulatory standpoint, advice doesn't actually come from a corporation.
Right. A corporation is just a piece of paper in Delaware.
Exactly. Advice comes from a flesh and blood person. Mm. And if that advice ruins someone's financial life, the state needs a real person to hold accountable.
And that is exactly what we're getting into today. Our mission for this deep dive is to completely master the rules surrounding investment advisor representatives.
Or IRRs, as we'll call them.
Yes, IRRs for short. And if you're studying for your Series 63, you know, this topic makes up roughly 5% of your exam, which sounds small.
It's what, maybe 3 or 4 questions?
Yeah, exactly. But here is the secret. The concepts governing IIRs overlap so heavily with the rules for broker-dealer agents that mastering this framework is going to save you points across multiple sections of the test.
That's a really great point. Because in previous deep dives, we spent a lot of time analyzing the advisory firm itself, right? The investment advisor, or IA.
The entity.
Right, the entity. But today, the camera zooms all the way in. We are looking entirely at the individuals who do the actual work on the ground.
And to help us navigate this, we're not just going to, like, read dry legal statutes, because that's terrible.
Look, noise that.
We are going to build a world.
Yep.
So we've got a recurring cast of fictional characters working at a fictional investment firm. And we're going to put them through the regulatory ringer today.
I love it. Let's meet them.
Okay, so picture the staff at our firm, which was founded by the very wealthy, very stressed Frank the founder.
Classic Frank.
First up, we have Fiona the financial planner. Now, Fiona is brilliant. Mm-hmm. She's highly active. She manages complex portfolios. She sits across the mahogany desk from clients. And she makes direct investment recommendations.
She's the star of the show. I mean, she's your classic frontline advisor. When the public thinks of a financial advisor, they're picturing Fiona.
Exactly. Next, we have Sammy the solicitor. Now, Sammy is this slick marketing guy.
Oh, I know the type.
Oh, you definitely do. He is phenomenal at networking, shaking hands at country clubs, bringing in high net worth clients. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing about Sammy. He wouldn't know a stock from a sock.
Right.
He has absolutely zero financial knowledge. He never looks at a portfolio. He just refers people to Fiona and gets a cut of the fee.
Which is a very common role in the industry. And as we'll see, a heavily scrutinized one by state regulator.
Definitely. And finally, we have Clueless Carl. Bless his heart.
Good old Carl.
Carl is the firm's receptionist and, like, data entry guy. Mm. He schedules appointments, answers the phones, makes sure the coffee machine works. He does not talk to clients about their money.
He just keeps the lights on.
Exactly. So we have Fiona, Sammy, and Clueless Carl. The central question for Section 1 is, how does the law categorize each of them?
Which brings us right to our first major regulatory hurdle. Before we can figure out how to register someone, we actually need to figure out if they even need to be registered.
Right, because not everyone in that skyscraper is an IAR.
Exactly. And the law doesn't just guess. The Uniform Securities Act uses a strict 2-part statutory test to define an IIR.
It's basically a binary system, right?
It is. If you meet both parts, you are an IIR and you fall under the state's jurisdiction. Miss even one part and you're outside of it.
Okay, so break down this 2-part test for us.
It's relatively elegant. Part A is association. The individual must be employed by or associated with an investment advisor.
So firm.
Right. And that can be either a state-registered firm or a massive federal-covered advisor. But you have to be attached to a firm. You can't just be some guy on a park bench handing out stock tips.
I see. And part B?
Part B is function. The individual must perform at least one of five specific functions defined by the statute. So association plus function equals IAR.
Okay, let's really lock in these five functions. I want to try an analogy here to make it stick.
Let's do it.
I want you to imagine that Frank the Founder's firm isn't a financial institution at all. Imagine it's a high-end, exclusive, Michelin-star restaurant.
Okay, I'm getting hungry, but go on.
Because the way a restaurant staff operates actually maps almost perfectly onto these five statutory functions.
I love a good operational analogy. Walk me through the dining room.
Okay, function number one is making recommendations or rendering advice regarding securities. In our restaurant, this is the sommelier.
Oh, the wine expert.
Right. The person who comes to your table, looks at what you ordered, looks at your tastes, and says, I highly recommend the 2015 Cabernet with that steak. They are giving direct, tailored advice.
And in our firm, that's Fiona telling a client, based on your retirement goals, buy this index fund. That's the most obvious trigger. If you are rendering direct advice regarding securities to a client, you meet the functional test. You are an IOR.
Okay, function number two, managing accounts or portfolios of clients. In the restaurant, this is the executive chef.
Building the menu.
Yes. The chef is in the back, deciding portions, managing the whole culinary experience. The diners don't even talk to the chef. They just hand over their money and trust the chef to feed them well.
And in the firm, this is Fiona again, but maybe in a scenario where she has discretionary authority over a client's portfolio.
Right. She's not just recommending trades. She's actively managing the assets herself without asking permission for every single move.
Exactly. Managing accounts is the second trigger. And it's an important distinction from just rendering advice. You're taking active control.
Okay. Function number three is determining which recommendation or advice should be given. Now, this one is a little more behind the scenes.
How so?
In our restaurant, imagine there's a food scientist or a back office researcher who never steps foot in the dining room.
Yeah.
They never talk to a diner. But they sit in an office and determine which seasonal ingredients are safe and high quality enough to even be allowed on the menu.
So in an investment firm, this is the research analyst.
Yes. They don't talk to clients, but they build the firm's approved list of securities that the frontline advisors are allowed to recommend.
You know, this one trips people up constantly on the exam. There's this persistent myth that you have to be client-facing to be an IRR.
But you don't.
You do not. The state recognizes that the person doing the foundational research is just as critical to the advice process as the person delivering it. If your function is determining the advice, even from a windowless basement, you're an IRR.
Wow. Okay. Function number four. Supervising employees who perform any of the previous functions.
The manager.
Exactly. The restaurant manager. The manager might not know how to cook a reduction sauce. They might not know wine, but they supervise the chef and the sommelier to make sure nobody gets food poisoning, right?
And the restaurant doesn't get sued.
Right. In the firm, this is the chief compliance officer or a managing director. If you supervise the people giving the advice, you are an IRR.
And if you think about the underlying logic of the law, that makes perfect sense. The regulators need jurisdiction over the supervisors.
Because if someone goes rogue.
Exactly. If a frontline advisor goes rogue and defrauds clients, the state needs to be able to hold the manager accountable for failing to supervise.
Makes sense. Okay, now we arrive at function number five. And this is the trap. The promoter.
Let's hear it.
In our restaurant analogy, this is the guy out on the busy street corner, a block away from the restaurant, handing out glossy flyers. He's yelling, "Hey, come eat at Frank's restaurant."
But he doesn't know how to cook.
No. He doesn't know what wine pairs with what. He just brings people in the door. So let's pause and ask you, the listener, a direct question.
Oh, this is a good one.
Okay, listener. Let's look at Sammy, the solicitor. Sammy never gives investment advice. He wouldn't know a stock from a sock. He just refers wealthy clients to Fiona and gets a referral fee. Does Sammy have to register as an IRR? Think about it for a second. Got your answer.
The answer is yes. Emphatically, yes. Soliciting, offering, or negotiating for the sale of investment advisory services is the fifth function.
And remember the binary rule, right?
Right. You only need to perform one of the five functions. Solicitation alone is entirely sufficient to make someone an IRR.
But I want to push back on this because it feels kind of counterintuitive. Why does the state care about the marketing guy?
It does seem weird at first.
Yeah. If Fiona's the one doing all the actual financial math, why does Sammy need a license just to hand out business cards?
Because you have to look at the psychology of financial fraud. When a client gets scammed, the damage usually isn't done by the person crunching numbers in the back.
Who is it done by?
It's done by the person who builds the false trust. The solicitor is the one looking the client in the eye, shaking their hand at the golf course, and convincing them to hand over their life savings.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Think about some of the most famous Ponzi schemes in history. The mastermind often didn't meet with every single victim. They used feeder funds and highly charismatic solicitors to lure people in.
So selling the services is just as dangerous as picking the stocks.
Exactly. The decision to hire the firm is the first and most important investment decision the client makes. Therefore, the person soliciting that decision must be regulated.
When you frame it like that, it makes total sense. You are selling trust. The state needs to verify you are trustworthy.
Precisely. And this is where the exam tries to get you. They will write a whole paragraph about how Sammy is purely a marketing employee who never looks at a spreadsheet.
Trying to trick you into saying he doesn't need to register?
Yep.
Don't fall for it. Solicitors are IIRs. Now, NASA does note that individual states have some minor discretion on third-party solicitors, but for the Series 53, treats solicitation as a triggering function.
Okay, so we know Fiona is an IIR because she makes recommendations. Sammy's an IIR because he solicits. But what about Clueless Carl?
Oh, Carl.
If Carl just sits at the front desk, schedules Fiona's appointments, and does bookkeeping, is he an IRR?
No, he is not. The statute is very specific here. Individuals who perform solely clerical or ministerial functions are excluded. So receptionists, HR.
Right. Data entry, basic bookkeepers. As long as their duties are strictly administrative, they don't meet Part B of our test. They aren't performing any of those five functions.
But let's throw a weird wrench into this. Let's say Clueless Carl inherits a massive amount of money from his wealthy aunt.
Lucky Carl.
Right. He takes that money and he buys a 20% ownership stake in Frank the founder's firm. He's now officially named a partner at the firm. Frank gives him a heavy glass plaque, puts Carl's name at the very top of the letterhead.
Okay, moving up in the world.
But Carl loves his routine. He says, Frank, I'm a partner now, but I still just want to answer the phones and do the bookkeeping. I don't want to manage money.
Does Carl's new fancy title as partner magically transform him into an IRR?
This is a classic exam scenario. It's what we call the partner paradox. And the answer is no. A partner, officer, or director is not automatically an IRR simply by virtue of their title.
So title means nothing.
Title means absolutely nothing to the state administrator. Function is everything. If partner Carl only handles clerical duties, he is not an IRR.
Listener, let that sink in. You could be the president of the company, but if your only function is payroll and HR, you are not an IRR. Function over title, always.
We should also briefly mention one other exclusion that trips people up. What if someone is providing advice, but not about securities?
Oh, like a tax preparer giving advice on tax law?
Exactly. Or a real estate agent giving advice on commercial property. Or an insurance agent selling fixed life insurance. Are they IRRs?
Well, the Uniform Securities Act is pretty clear in its name, right? It only cares about securities.
So if there's no security involved, the securities regulator has no jurisdiction over you.
Precisely. So, to finalize our cast, Fiona is in, Sammy is in, Carl is out, even with a fancy title.
All right. Moving on to section two. We've identified that Fiona and Sammy are officially acting as IIRs. But they can't just walk into the office and start doing the work. They have to prove to the state that they are qualified.
They need to pass the examinations or find a golden ticket to skip them entirely.
The golden tickets. Okay, let's lay out the examination pathways first. Pathway number one is what I call the standalone test.
The Series 65.
Yes, officially known as the Uniform Investment Advisor Law Examination. If you pass the 65 within 2 years of applying for registration, you meet the exam requirement. Boom, done.
You've proven you understand fiduciary duty, portfolio theory, state law.
And pathway number two is the combination route.
This is usually for people already heavily entrenched in the broker-dealer side of the world who want to add advisory services. Instead of the 65, you can use a combination of three exams. Yes, the Series 66 plus the Series 7 plus the SIE, which is the Securities Industry Essentials exam.
Now, I want to point out a very common trick here. The exam loves to ask if passing the Series 66 alone makes you qualified to be an IRR. Let's think about that. The 66 is a NASA exam, just like the 65. So does the 66 on its own get you through the gate?
Absolutely not. The Series 66 is literally designed to be half of a pair. It's conceptually treated as equivalent to having the Series 63 and the 65 combined, but only if you also hold the Series 7.
Because the Series 7 covers the actual investment products, right?
Stocks, bonds, options. The 66 just covers the state law. Therefore, the Series 66 alone is useless without the 7.
And we also need to keep an eye on the ticking clock for these exams. The 65, the 66, and the 7 all operate on a 2-year validity window.
Meaning, if you pass them, you have 2 years to get officially registered with a firm.
If you wait 25 months to get a job, your scores expire, and you have to sit in that testing center all over again. The SIE gives you a bit more breathing room with a 4-year window, though.
But what if someone doesn't want to take the exams at all? What if Fiona has been a professional in finance for a decade? She has a wall full of framed credentials, and she thinks the Series 65 is beneath her. Can she bypass it?
She can, but only if she holds one of the golden tickets. NASA has approved a very specific closed universe of 5 professional designations.
And if you have one of these 5 credentials, current and in good standing, it waives the entire examination requirement.
You don't take the 65, you don't take the 66, you don't take the 7, you just hand them your credential. So what are the 5?
You need to memorize these acronyms for the exam. Number 1 is the CFP, Certified Financial Planner. Number 2 is the CHFC, Chartered Financial Consultant. Number 3 is the PFS, Personal Financial Specialist. Number 4 is the CFA, Chartered Financial Analyst. And number 5 is the CIMA, Certified Investment Management Analyst.
Okay, I want to pause on this because there's an assumption people make that gets them in major trouble.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Listener, I have a direct question for you. Let's say our brilliant Fiona is a CPA, a certified public accountant. She's been a CPA for 20 years. She is brilliant with numbers and taxes. If she brings her CPA license to the state administrator, does it waive the Series 65? Does CPA equal a golden ticket? Think about it.
Okay,
what's the answer?
It absolutely does not. And the exam will try to trick you with exactly this scenario. They will write a question that makes the CPA sound incredibly qualified. But a CPA license alone does nothing for IIR exam waivers.
I have to ask why. Because to the average person, a CPA seems like the ultimate financial expert. If you trust them with your taxes, why wouldn't the state trust them to give investment advice?
It comes down to the fundamental difference between accounting and advising. Accounting is, by its nature, backward-looking.
Backward-looking, meaning what?
A CPA looks at a ledger to determine what happened last year and how to report it accurately. They are experts in tax code and historical record-keeping. Investment advising is forward-looking. It involves portfolio theory, risk tolerance, market dynamics, predicting future performance. The state regulators determined that knowing how to file a corporate tax return does not mean you know how to build a diversified retirement portfolio.
That makes perfect sense. So what if Fiona, the CPA, wants the waiver?
She can get it, but she must also earn the PFS designation, the Personal Financial Specialist credential. That is a specific additional certification granted by the Accounting Institute that proves she actually studied financial planning.
So CPA alone, no waiver. CPA plus PFS, waiver granted.
Exactly.
And for anyone using slightly older study materials, I want to flag a historical note. You might see the acronym CIC Chartered Investment Counselor listed as a waiver. Cross it out. NASA replaced the CIC with the CIMA designation back in May of 2024.
Yep, the CIC program is dead. So the current list is CFP, CHFC, PFS, CFA, and CIMA.
Okay, so let's talk about what happens when you decide to take a break from the industry. Let's say Fiona passes her Series 65. She is registered and working for Frank the Founder for 5 years. Then she gets burned out.
It happens all the time.
She quits, lets her registration lapse, and goes to live on a beach in Bali to find herself. How long does her exam score stay valid while she's sitting on that beach?
Well, the exams stay valid as long as you're continuously registered. But the literal moment she unregisters, a 2-year ticking clock starts.
So if she stays in Bali for 3 years,
her Series 65 is completely dead. The state treats her like a brand new person who has never taken a test. She has to study and sit for it all over again.
But wait, what about the FANRA Maintaining Qualifications Program, the MQP? Doesn't that program specifically exist to let people extend their exam validity up to 5 years if they do continuing education?
This is a fantastic point and a brutal exam trap. The FANRA MQP does allow an individual to maintain their qualifications for up to 5 years. However, you have to look at the jurisdiction.
Right, FINRA versus NASA.
Exactly. FINRA oversees broker-dealers. They only control FINRA exams, like the Series 7 and the SI. The Series 65 and 66 are NASA exams. They are controlled by the states.
And NASA and FINRA do not always play nice.
They do not. So, if Fiona signs up for the MQP while she's in Bali, the program will preserve her Series 7 and her SI for 5 years, but it does absolutely nothing to save her Series 65 or 66.
Wow. So those state exams just turn into pumpkins after exactly 2 years of being unregistered, period.
Period. The MQP cannot save a state exam.
That is incredibly tricky.
Extremely. If she was relying on the Series 66 and Series 7 combination pathway, the MQP saves the 7, but the 66 still dies, which means her ability to register as an IRR is gone anyway. She'd still have to retake the 66.
Brutal. Okay, let's bring this all back to the big why. Fiona passes the Series 65. She walks out of the testing center, looks at the paper that says pass, and yells, "I am officially an investment advisor representative." Is she right?
No, she is not. And this is perhaps the most fundamental conceptual hurdle for people new to securities law. Passing the exam does not make you an IRR.
It doesn't.
It just makes you eligible to apply to become an IRR. There is no such thing as a freestanding, independent IIR. You cannot hang a shingle on your front door that just says Fiona IRR.
You need a sponsoring firm.
Exactly. Passing the test is just forging the key. You still need a firm to give you a door to unlock.
Which perfectly transitions us to section three, the actual mechanics of registration. Fiona has her passing score. She has a job offer from Freck the founder. How does the paperwork actually flow?
It all revolves around a massive, invasive document called Form U4, the Uniform Application for Securities Industry Registration.
The dreaded U4.
Yes. Under the law, Fiona is technically the applicant, but in reality, Frank's firm takes all of Fiona's info and submits the Form U4 on her behalf through a centralized computer system called the IRRD.
Form U4 is a beast.
Yeah.
If you've never seen one, listener, it asks for everything. It wants your 10-year employment history with no gaps, every residential address you've had for 5 years, any aliases.
And the background check section.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever been convicted of a felony? Charged with a felony? Have you ever had a customer write a letter complaining about you? A personal bankruptcy? It all goes on the U4.
The state needs all this info to determine if you are a risk to the public. And along with the U4, Fiona's firm has to submit a filing fee. But more importantly, she has to submit a specific legal document called a consent to service of process.
The consent to service of process. I always describe this to people as a permanent, invisible regulatory tattoo.
A tattoo. That's a unique way to put it. I like it.
Think about why it exists. Let's say a fraudulent IR scams clients out of millions. The state administrator wants to sue him, but the guy unregisters and moves to a remote cabin where no one can find him.
Right. Normally, you have to physically hand someone legal papers to sue them.
Exactly. You have to serve them. If you can't find them, you can't sue them. The consent to service of process fixes that loophole.
When Fiona files this document on day one, she is permanently appointing the state administrator as her legal agent to receive non-criminal legal papers related to securities. It's basically saying, if you can't find me 10 years from now, you can just serve the lawsuit to the state administrator's office, and legally, it counts as if you handed it directly to me.
And it never goes away.
Never. Even if she leaves the industry, that consent remains valid forever. It's a regulatory tattoo.
That is very vivid and legally accurate. It prevents bad actors from avoiding lawsuits by dodging a process server.
Okay, listener, another direct question for you. Fiona's firm submits the U4, the filing fee, and her creepy regulatory tattoo on June 1st. On what day does the state administrator review the file, stamp it, and say, "I approve Fiona's registration"? Think about the legal weight of the word approve.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the trick here?
This is a massive terminology trap. The administrator never approves a registration. Never. Regulators despise the word approve because it implies they are endorsing the person. If they approve Fiona and she turns out to be a criminal, clients will say, "But the state approved her."
Right. The state said she was good.
Exactly. The state does not guarantee anyone is good. They just verify you submitted the paperwork. Therefore, the registration simply becomes effective.
Effective. If the exam asks you when the administrator approves the license, the answer is never. So when does it become effective?
Absent a denial order, the registration automatically becomes effective at noon on the 30th day after a complete application is filed.
Noon on the 30th day. Not immediately upon filing. Not on day 30 at midnight. Noon. And note the word complete.
Yes. If Frank submits the U4 but forgets the check for the filing fee, the 30-day clock doesn't even start ticking.
Now, there is an interesting exception to this U4 waiting period, right? Automatic registration.
Yes, but it applies strictly to partners, officers, and directors.
Let's bring back Clueless Carl to illustrate this, but let's change his reality a bit. Imagine a scenario where Carl is actually a founding partner alongside Frank. And this time, Carl actually does advise clients.
Okay, so he's an IRR by function and a top-level partner by title.
Right. When the IA firm itself registers with the state for the very first time, does Carl have to file his own separate U-4 and wait 30 days?
No, he doesn't. And the logic here is efficiency. When the firm registers, they fill out a massive document called Form ADV. On that form, the state already forces the firm to disclose the backgrounds of all the partners, officers, and directors.
So the state is already vetting Carl.
Exactly. It would be redundant to make him file U-4 and wait again. Yep. So the registration of the investment advisor automatically constitutes the registration of any IRR who is a partner, officer, or director. They just get swept in.
But Fiona, who is just a standard employee, she still has to file her OU4 and wait 30 days?
Correct. It only applies to the top brass.
Now, regardless of how they registered or when they registered, what happens to everyone's license at the end of the year?
Every single IRR registration in the country turns into a pumpkin on December 31st.
Every single one. It doesn't matter if Fiona got her registration effective on December 29th. 2 days later, on December 31st, it expires. Everyone has to renew and pay a fee at the end of the calendar year.
It keeps the state's database perfectly aligned. Which brings us to Section 4, quite possibly the single most critical, highly tested distinction in this entire deep dive.
Where to register.
Yes. We know how Fiona registers. But where does she file that U-4?
Does she file it in her home state, the state where her clients live? All 50 states. This is where the exam separates the people who just memorize flashcards from the people who actually understand the architecture of financial law.
To understand this, we have to look briefly at history. Back in the day, an advisor had to register in every single state they did business in, complying with 50 different sets of rules.
Sounds like a nightmare for national firms.
It was. So in 1996, Congress passed NSMIA, the National Securities Markets Improvement Act. Congress essentially split the regulatory world in half. They said the SEC will regulate the giant national firms and the states will regulate the smaller local firms.
So the entire rule for where an IAR registers hinges on one question. Yeah. Who does Fiona work for?
Exactly. Does she work for a state registered investment advisor or a federal covered advisor? The rules are completely opposite.
Okay, let's do a side-by-side comparison. Let's start with the state-registered IA. These are the smaller firms, usually managing less than $100 million in client assets. If Fiona works for a state-registered firm, what's the rule?
She must register as an IIR in every state where the firm is registered, AD, where she either has clients or has a place of business. Essentially, if she's interacting with retail clients in a state, she needs to be registered there. Client location dictates registration.
Client location dictates registration. Got it. But what if she works for a federal covered advisor? The massive Wall Street monoliths managing over $100 million. They don't register with the state at all. So how does the state regulate their IRRs?
This is where the rule flips entirely. For an IRR of a federal covered advisor, client location no longer matters.
Oh, I'm lying.
The federal government preempts the state. The only thing that matters is the place of business. An IIR of a federal covered advisor must register only in the states where they have a physical place of business.
Okay, listener, it's scenario time. This exact concept is almost guaranteed to be on your exam. Let's say Fiona works for a massive federal covered advisor. Her office, the physical building she drives to every morning, is in New York. Yeah. However, she's a road warrior. She gets in her car and drives out to New Jersey, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania to meet with her 50 wealthy clients.
That's a lot of driving.
Right. She has dozens of clients in those other states. So, listener, where does Fiona need to register as an IR? Think about the rule. Trace the logic. What's the answer?
The answer is only New York. Because her firm is a federal covered advisor, the state regulators in New Jersey, CT, and PA are legally barred by federal law from requiring her to register simply because she doesn't have an office there.
It does not matter that she has 50 clients in those states. No place of business means no state registration.
That concept blows people's minds. They think, but she has clients there. She's giving financial advice in New Jersey.
Right.
But Congress decided the states shouldn't overregulate the firm's employees unless there is a physical desk, a physical office in that specific state. So she only registers in NY.
But if we flip the scenario and say she works for a state-registered IA.
Oh.
If she works for a smaller state registered firm, the federal preemption doesn't exist.
Mm.
Suddenly she has to register in NY, NJ, CT, and PA because client location suddenly matters again. You must determine the firm type first. Okay, let's explore an exception. Let's go back to the state registered firm scenario. Fiona works in New York. no physical office in New Jersey. But she does have a few clients who retired and moved to New Jersey. Is there any way she can avoid registering in NJ?
Yes, through what is called the de minimis exemption. It essentially says, if your footprint in a state is incredibly small, we won't force you through the nightmare of registration.
What are the conditions?
Condition one is absolute. No place of business in the state. If you have an office there, the exemption is dead.
Okay.
Assuming you have no office, condition two gives you options. You must either have only institutional clients in that state, like banks or pension plans, or are, if you have regular, everyday, non-institutional clients, you cannot have more than five of them in a rolling 12-month period.
So no office, A&D 5, or fewer retail clients in a 12-month period. The logic here is accommodating modern life, right? If your NY client buys a winter home in Florida, you shouldn't have to register in Florida just for one client.
Exactly. And here's the trap. The exam will give you a scenario where Fiona has only one client in New Jersey. She thinks, great, I'm well under the five client limit. I don't need to register. But then she decides to rent a tiny one-desk windowless satellite office in a New Jersey strip mall just to have a convenient place to meet that one client. What happens to her exemption?
It vanishes instantly.
Instantly. The moment she establishes a physical place of business, the five-client rule goes out the window. One client, zero clients, it doesn't matter. If you have an office, you must register.
That is a phenomenal exam trap. Here's another one related to money. Let's talk about financial requirements. Fiona is a star IIR. She manages millions. She has full discretionary authority over client funds.
Okay.
The state administrator looks at her and says, Fiona, you need to post a $50,000 surety bond and prove your personal net worth is at least $35,000 to ensure you are financially stable. Is the administrator allowed to demand that of an individual IIR?
Emphatically, no. The Uniform Securities Act authorizes the administrator to set minimum capital and bonding requirements for broker-dealers and for investment advisor firms. But the term investment advisor representative never appears in those financial provisions.
But why? If Fiona manages millions, shouldn't she have to prove she isn't secretly broke?
Because the financial liability rests entirely on the firm. If Fiona makes a catastrophic error, the client is going to sue Frank, the founder's firm. The firm holds the deep pockets. The firm might need to post a bond, but Fiona, the individual employee, does not.
So don't let an exam question try to make you apply firm-level financial requirements to the individual IRR. The firm needs the money. The individual just needs the brain and the clean record.
Exactly.
Okay, that brings us to Section 5, leaving the firm and post-registration duties. Life happens. People get fired. People retire. Fiona has been happily registered for 3 years. Then she gets a massively lucrative offer from a rival firm. She walks into Frank's office, hands him a letter, and says, I quit. What happens to her IR registration at that exact moment?
It immediately becomes inactive. This goes back to tied registration. There is no such thing as a freelance IRR. Your registration is permanently tied to your sponsoring firm. The literal moment she resigns, her registration goes dormant. She cannot legally give investment advice until she gets hired by the new firm and a brand new U4 becomes effective.
So no grace period. Yeah. She can't just casually advise friends from her living room while taking a 2-week vacation between jobs.
Absolutely not. Unregistered is unregistered.
Okay, listener, another question for you. Fiona quits. The state obviously needs to know she quit so they can update the database. Who has the legal burden to file the paperwork and tell the administrator that Fiona left? Is it Fiona or is it Frank the founder? What do you think?
It depends. And this is another elegant little rule that flips entirely based on the firm type.
How so?
If Fiona works for a state registered IA, then the firm must promptly notify the administrator. But if she works for a federal covered advisor, then the firm doesn't notify the state. Fiona, the individual IRR, must promptly notify the administrator.
I always laugh at this one because it makes total logical sense if you just think about who the state actually has on speed dial.
Exactly.
If it's a state-registered firm, the state regulator knows Frank. They registered his firm. So they say, hey, Frank, you are our regulated entity. Tell us when your people leave.
Right.
But if it's a federal-covered advisor, the SEC regulates the firm. The state regulator doesn't have a direct line to the giant Wall Street monolith, but they do have a direct line to Fiona, because she filed her U4 with them. So they say, hey, since we can't force your boss to talk to us, you have to tell us when you quit.
The burden falls on whichever party is directly under the state's jurisdiction.
So how do they notify the state? We used Form U-4 to get in. How do you get out?
You get out via Form U-5, the Uniform Termination Notice. It must be filed through the IIRD within 30 days of termination. And it doesn't just say Fiona left. It asks why she left. Was it voluntary, discharged, or was she permitted to resign?
Permitted to resign. This is the spicy hypothetical. Let's bring back Sammy the solicitor. Sammy gets caught lying to a wealthy client about historical returns, a huge ethics violation.
Oh.
Frank, the founder, calls Sammy in and says, you lied. You can either write a resignation letter today, or I will fire you for cause tomorrow. Your choice. Sammy writes the letter and voluntarily quits. When Frank files the U-5, can he just check voluntary resignation?
No, that is a massive violation and a classic exam trap. Historically, rogue brokers would do terrible things, quit one step ahead of the axe, and move to a new firm with a clean record because they technically resigned.
So regulators created the permitted to resign category to stop that.
Exactly. If an employee resigns while under internal investigation, the firm must check the box for permitted to resign. This creates a permanent red flag on Sammy's public record. You cannot hide a scandal behind a polite resignation letter.
The state demands the ugly truth. Now, what if someone isn't leaving the firm, but something in their personal life changes? Fiona gets married, changes her last name, moves to a new house. What happens to that U-4 she filed 3 years ago?
The NASA model rule places a strict obligation to keep the form U-4 current. If any info becomes materially inaccurate, an amendment must be filed promptly.
And what does promptly mean for an IR?
It explicitly means within 30 days of the event.
Let's focus on the criminal aspect, because that triggers a correcting amendment. Say Fiona goes out on Saturday night, gets into a massive bar fight, and gets charged with felony assault. Not convicted, just charged. Mm-hmm. Can she wait to update her U-4 until the judge's gavel drops?
She cannot wait. She must update it within 30 days of the charge. The U-4 specifically asks if you have ever been charged with a felony. The literal moment she is charged, her previous answer of no becomes materially inaccurate.
They don't want to wait for the criminal justice system to finish its work.
Right, which could take years. They want to know about potential risks immediately.
Okay, one more thing on post-registration duties, record keeping. A typical advisory firm generates millions of emails and trade tickets every year. Who holds the statutory legal duty to store all these records? Is it Fiona's job to keep a giant locked filing cabinet of her own emails?
Another trap. The statutory record-keeping duty applies exclusively to the investment advisor, the firm, not the individual IIR. Yes, Fiona generates the records, but the legal obligation to maintain the books belongs to Frank's firm.
Don't let an exam question trick you into assigning firm-level duties to the individual employee.
Exactly.
So let's look at what happens when things go seriously wrong. Section 6. The administrator's wrath. What if the state administrator decides they want to kick you out of the industry? Can they just ban you because they don't like you?
No, the administrator wields tremendous power, but it isn't absolute. To take disciplinary action against an IIR's registration, the administrator must have two O things. First, they must make a formal finding that the action is in the public interest. Second, they must have at least one specific statutory ground listed in the Uniform Securities Act.
Some grounds are obvious. Willful violation of securities laws, felony conviction of the last 10 years, securities-related misdemeanors. But let's talk about a weird one. Insolvency.
Law, the insolvency trap.
Yeah. Earlier, you said Fiona has no minimum net worth requirement. So what if Fiona makes terrible personal choices, racks up massive credit card debt, and personally files for bankruptcy? Can the administrator revoke her IRR license?
Yes, they can. And this is a very nuanced trap. We established an IRR has no minimum net worth floor, but the statute specifically lists insolvency, meaning your liabilities exceed your assets, as a statutory ground for revocation for any registrant. Since Fiona is a registrant, her own personal insolvency I as a valid ground to revoke her license.
But wait, isn't that just kicking someone when they're down? If she didn't steal it from a client, why does her personal credit card debt mean she loses her job?
Risk mitigation. Regulators study behavior. When an individual handling millions of dollars of other people's money becomes personally desperate and insolvent, the statistical risk of embezzlement skyrockets. Mm. The state views personal insolvency as a massive red flag regarding your ability to act as a fiduciary.
Okay, but let's connect this to a previous deep dive. I distinctly remember learning that a firm cannot be punished just because one of its executives goes bankrupt.
Exactly. And that is the nuance you have to master. If Fiona goes bankrupt, the administrator can revoke Fiona's license. But the administrator cannot revoke Frank's firm's license based on Fiona's personal bankruptcy.
The firm is protected, but the executive is not. That is a phenomenal distinction for the exam. Okay, what about due process? Let's say the administrator finds out Sammy the solicitor is actively stealing money. Can the administrator instantly, permanently revoke his license via an email on a Friday afternoon?
No, we have constitutional due process. A final order to permanently revoke a license requires three things: prior notice to Sammy and his firm, an opportunity for a hearing, and written findings of fact and conclusions of law.
But if Sammy is actively stealing money today, doesn't the state need to stop him immediately? Waiting for a hearing could take weeks.
They can stop him immediately using what's called a summary order. A summary order temporarily suspends the license immediately, pending a final determination.
And then Sammy can request a hearing.
Yes. If he requests a hearing in writing, the administrator must set the hearing date within 15 days of receiving that request.
Suspend first, ask questions later, but within 15 days. Now, let's talk about the 90-day rule. This is one of my favorite quirky rules.
The fun one.
Let's say Fiona has a dark past. 5 years ago, she had her real estate license revoked in another state for doing something shady. When she fills out her Form U-4 to become an IAR, she is completely honest. She fully discloses the real estate revocation. The administrator reads it, shrugs, and lets her registration become effective. A year later, the administrator gets mad at Fiona for something unrelated, but they don't have proof. So they say, you know what? I'm revoking your IAR license right now because of that real estate thing from 5 years ago. Can they do that?
No, they cannot. The 90-day rule strictly states that if an applicant fully discloses a final judicial or administrative order on their application, the administrator has exactly 90 days after the effective date to launch a proceeding based solely on that disclosed fact.
So if they sleep on it for 91 days,
they lose the right to use that specific historical fact against her.
It's basically a statute of limitations on stuff you openly admitted to. A speak now or forever hold your peace rule for regulators.
Exactly. But to be very clear, if she committed a new W violation, they can absolutely go after her for that. The 90-day rule only protects the specific final orders she proactively disclosed prior to registration.
Okay, one more scenario on leaving the industry. Sammy the solicitor sees regulators sniffing around. He knows he's about to get caught for a massive willful violation. Before they can formally charge him, he says, "You can't fire me, I retire." He logs into IRD and files to withdraw his registration entirely. He thinks he can outrun the regulators, can he?
You cannot outrun the regulators. Withdrawal takes 30 days to become effective. During those 30 days, the administrator can freeze the withdrawal process and launch a disciplinary proceeding.
But what if he manages to get through the 30 days? Let's say the state was slow, the 30 days pass, and Sammy is officially withdrawn and unregistered. Is he safe?
Still no. Even after a clean withdrawal becomes effective, the administrator retains jurisdiction for a full 1 year to retroactively launch a revocation proceeding for a past willful violation.
Wow.
They can pull him back in, revoke his license on the public record, and permanently bar him from the industry. The long arm of the law has a 1 year tail on it.
So we've covered the entire life cycle of an IIR. To really lock this in, Section 7 is our final showdown. IRR versus agent. If you want to crush this Area 63, the exam loves to test your ability to tell an IRR apart from an agent, just to reset the definitions. An IRR works for an investment advisor and gets paid a fee to give advice. They're fiduciaries. An agent works for a broker-dealer and gets paid commissions to execute trades, advice versus sales. Let's do a ping pong match of the similarities first.
Okay, let's run through them quickly. Number one, both use Form U-4 to register and Form U-5 to terminate. Number two, both have tied registration. Leave the firm. License is inactive immediately.
Number three, both require that irrevocable consent to service of process tattoo. Number four, both expire on December 31st and require annual renewal.
Number five, both face the exact same statutory grounds for denial or revocation. And number six, both have a 30-day withdrawal period with a 1 year regulatory tail.
Awesome. Those are the similarities. Now for the differences, I'll name a category and let's explore how it differs for an agent versus an IIR. First up, the exams.
For an agent, the state exam is the Series 63. For an IIR, the state exam is the Series 65 or the Series 66 combination.
Second difference, waivers. If I have a fancy professional designation like a CFP, what happens?
For an agent taking the 63, there are NO waivers. A CFP does not waive the Series 63 because the CFP is about planning, not executing trades. For an IRR taking the Series 65, the CFP completely waives the exam requirement. IRRs get the golden tickets. Agents do not.
That is huge.
Yeah.
Okay, third difference. The de minimis exemption. The client count limits.
For an agent, there is no de minimis exemption. If an agent executes even one single trade for a retail client in a state, they must be registered in that state. Sales are transactional. For an IRR, they get the 5-client NO office exemption. Because advising a snowbird client from afar is viewed differently than cold calling someone to sell a stock, agents never get this leeway.
Fourth difference, the place of business rule for federal covered firms.
This one doesn't even exist for agents because there is no such thing as a federal covered broker dealer. Agent registration is always based on where the client is. For IRRs, if they work for a federal covered advisor, client location goes out the window and they only register where they have a physical place of business.
And the final difference, termination notice. When the person quits, who notifies the state administrator?
For an agent, it is a dual requirement. Both the firm and the agent must notify the administrator. For an IRR, it is exactly one party. State registered IA, the firm notifies. Federal covered IA, the IRR notifies. But it's only ever one of them, not both.
That side-by-side comparison is worth its weight in gold on exam day. You will absolutely see questions testing those specific philosophical differences.
It really just comes down to understanding what the state is trying to protect the integrity of the advice or the execution of the sale.
Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of ground today. It's time for our rapid-fire recap. I'm going to blast through the top 5 testable takeaways. Lock these into your brain. Number 1, solicitors are IRRs, but administrative staff are not. Sammy the solicitor must register because he sells trust. Clueless Carl, the receptionist, does not, even if he buys a partnership stake, function over title. Number 2, passing the Series 65 does not make you an IRR, it just gives you the right to apply. You still need an investment advisor firm to sponsor your U4. Tied registration is mandatory.
Critical to remember.
Number 3, federal covered IRRs register only where they have a physical place of business. Client location means nothing for them. State-registered IRRs care about client location. Know the difference. Number 4, IRRs has zero bonding or net worth requirements. The state can demand a bond from the firm, but they cannot demand a personal bond from Fiona, the financial planner, even if she has discretion over millions.
The firm needs the money, not Fiona.
And number 5, IRR termination notice is a one-party job. State firm, the firm tells the state. Federal firm, the IRR tells the state. Contrast that with agents where both parties have to notify.
That is an excellent summary of the core mechanics.
All right, as we wrap up, I want to leave you, the listener, with something to ponder, a final thought to chew on as you continue studying.
Think about the overarching philosophy we started with. The entire regulatory framework we just spent an hour dissecting is designed to pierce the corporate veil. An investment firm can have billions in assets and a logo recognized around the world. But the law ensures that every single piece of advice, every recommendation, every solicitation is ultimately tied to a flesh and blood human being.
Yeah.
The state tracks your personal record, your background, your U4 disclosures, and your physical location. You aren't just an employee hiding behind a corporate shield. You are the regulated entity. The trust client's place in the market doesn't rest on the firm. It rests on you.
That is heavy, but it is exactly why these exams are so rigorous. They need to know you take that responsibility seriously. Keep studying, keep grinding through those practice questions, and go crush the Series 63. You've got this.